This is KJZZ, your member-supported news and information station. I'm Tiara Vian, and here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. For the week of June 11th, here are a few top stories. In the news, this week the main library in Phoenix opens after massive storm damage. From the show, here's KJZZ's Mark Brody.
Last July, a pipe burst on the fifth floor of Phoenix's Burton Barr Central Library during a monsoon that caused flooding that forced the library to close. Now, after nearly a year, it's set to reopen on Saturday, and workers are hustling to make sure the library is ready. I visited Burton Barr earlier this week to see how those preparations are coming and to see what's changed inside the library since it was last open. Lee Franklin, Community Relations Manager for Phoenix Public Library, was my tour guide. We started on the first floor in the children's area.
All five floors had water. And what that meant for all five floors was that at a minimum, we had to replace all the carpet. So all the carpet is new. But a place like Children's, where it's located in the southeast corner of the first floor, did not get water damage. It didn't reach back there. But what we had on in our plans and our future plans was to make some significant upgrades and expansion of Children's. We were hoping to do sometime in the next couple of years, and we were able to speed that schedule up, and take care of the bulk of that during the time that we were closed.
That means the area is three times its original size and has more kids' books. And that's a common theme at the library. Changes or improvements officials were planning on making at some point got done while the building was closed to recover from the flooding. That includes new computers and tabletops and more outlets to charge your phone, among other things. Then there were the items that had to be changed out because of the flooding, like carpets. As Franklin and I moved to the second floor, she pointed out the College Depot area, which is also substantially bigger now than it was before.
What you're looking at here, besides hearing the drilling, is we'll walk down this little hallway and we'll end up in a large flexible assembly room that will allow College Depot to almost triple the amount of programming that they're able to offer, not just the numbers of sessions, but we're able to have more expertise come because we'll have breakout spaces.
It seems like in some regards, while this was certainly not something that anybody wanted to have happen, in some ways, Phoenix residents are getting sort of an improved product mm-hmm. at the end of it. Things that you had wanted to do anyway, this just gave you an opportunity to maybe do them a little sooner, a little more quickly maybe,
yeah.
And that you're trying to almost make the best of what was a pretty bad situation.
I think that, yes, making the best of a bad situation is something you can always count on from a public library. Very resilient, very resourceful. We did not want this to come about this way. I will, be sure to say that having what happened is not what any of us wanted. But we also know we have to be responsible for the community resource that we manage. And we are always wanting to expand services, always wanting to enhance those, always wanting to be responsive to our customers and what they're asking for. But we have to balance that with taking good care of facilities and budgets.
There's been a lot of discussion about what the closure of this facility meant for the community. I'm wondering to you what its reopening means to this community.
Everything we have heard is excitement. And yes, we were very, very sensitive. That is another thing you can always count on from librarians is an actual, maybe a physical hurt when they can't do what they set out to do, which is help our community. We keenly missed being able to do that here in Central Phoenix.
Phoenix City Manager Ed Zerker has told the city council the fixes have cost around $9 million so far. After Burton Barr closed, the city opened a temporary library at Park Central Mall. Lee Franklin says that location saw about a quarter of the number of visitors that Burton Barr sees. As we headed to the library's fourth floor, we took a look at changes to its makerspace.
All right, so we are in Mock. What Mock is, or Mock here did have, it's right under, it's the floor below where the pipe broke. So there was a lot of water here. But the way we've put Mock back is we have a state-of-the-art makerspace floor that's in the center of the area, the room. And what that means is we can be really flexible with the space. And sometimes some of these upgrades, they may seem like they don't matter much. And then you realize how much the surface, the floor, what kind of product is on the floor means when you're trying to have a space where you have a lot of people that move around a lot. The floor surface tends to be, you know, it can either really, really help that or it can hinder it.
Did you find that this time that the library was closed and you were doing all this work on it, was this in some ways sort of an opportunity to rethink the way that people use the library and how the library can better serve the people who are using it?
Yeah, that's a good question. And yes, again, one of the things that people can count on from librarians and the staff that provide our services is that we listen and we pay attention to what our customers are asking for. Sometimes we're not able to do everything that they are requesting, but we always factor that in. And there was some of that. If we could do some things different with our makerspace, with Mach 1, what would we like to do? And so fortunately, we were able to do that and bring this service back on better and stronger.
Can you describe what the process has been like to get the library ready to reopen on Saturday? I mean, just looking around
we're
here.
We're in a quiet space now, yeah.
Right, I mean, looking around, I mean, there are work people all over the place doing all sorts of things, mm-hmm. but I would imagine there's things like getting books on the shelves and mm-hmm. setting computers up and all that stuff. I mean, it seems mm-hmm. like just such a massive undertaking.
Yeah, yes, it is. There's a lot of moving parts, and it seems a little bit of a mixture of magic and science. And so there's very organized chaos going on these couple of floors. So all of the materials that were at our Park Central location came from Burton Barr. When this happened last summer, we took as much of the materials from this building as we possibly could fit into our system and put it out into the system. And so that stuff is slowly coming back. And it takes a little bit. So what we've done is we've closed down our Park Central location, brought all that stuff back here, because all the furniture, all the shelving, all of the computers, all of the books, all the staff were normally assigned at Burton Barr. So that's all come back, and now that's what they're doing, is making sure that that stuff gets put back on the shelves in a library order so that we can find it and customers can find it.
Fifth floor.
The last stop on our tour was, with apologies to Hamilton, the room where it happened, where people were busy reshelving books.
We'll go to the right here. We're walking into the northwest corner of the fifth floor, or this area is what we call the Great Reading Room. And this corner is right, if you look right up in, that is where the pipe was ruptured, and this is where the water was raining down. This floor, because there are 35-foot ceilings here, the floor of the fifth floor is what's called a raised floor, which means there's a crawl space underneath it, and that's where the air conditioning venting and all of the IT wiring and all of the electrical wiring is in the floor. So that was a big open space, so water traveled and then rained down on the other four floors below us. So but that's where the pipe was, and so this section here, the collection is the reference collection, and we are replacing the reference collection. It will look a little bit different than it did originally.
How much had to change about the engineering and the construction and the structure of this building to make sure that you're sort of future-proofed against anything right. like this happening again?
The one thing that changed that we made sure is, if you look up, and for those that come visit us at Burton Barr, if you come to the fifth floor and you look up, you'll see a corrugated steel ceiling, and you will see a sprinkler head. So see what the sprinkler head is. You can see the pipe that it's attached, that it plugs into. So that is the significant difference. That pipe before was between, it was hidden behind the ceiling. It was between the ceiling and the roof. So the only thing visible or below the ceiling was the sprinkler head itself. So now with these pipes exposed, which really you have to look close to see it, but having those pipes exposed means that we can lay eyes on them and they're easier for us to inspect regularly. And if there's a problem with one of them, or if we need to do maintenance or repair, we can get to them. That was part of the challenge. You know, we would have to either go through the roof or come up through the ceiling to get to that infrastructure that was in there. So that was one thing that we made sure of when this was put back.
What goes through your mind when you stand here knowing you know, and having seen what you saw last summer and looking at people reshelving the books and knowing that in just a couple of days, this place will be back open again.
Really, it's excitement about understand like how much this means to people to be able to come in here and the sanctuary and the refuge that they find in public libraries. That's what I think about when I compare that night to today is knowing like that night, understanding that this was going to be not accessible to people for an amount of time. And then today standing here looking and knowing what it's going to mean to people to be able to come back in here Saturday morning. And it does kind of give me chills a little bit.
That was Lee Franklin, Community Relations Manager for Phoenix Public Library. After being closed for nearly a year, Burton Barr Central Library will reopen on Saturday.
From the KJZZ original production, The Show, here's host Steve Goldstein.
Arizona, and more specifically the Valley, are on the cusp of significant decisions and changes related to water usage. A drought contingency plan is on the horizon, as is a Colorado River shortage declaration. Last week on the show, I spoke with Joanna Allhands of the Arizona Republic about some of her ideas for preventing a water crisis in the state. She listed several things we should do, but wasn't overly optimistic about action being taken rapidly.
We're doing things kind of going backwards. There is not any sort of consensus on a drought contingency plan for Lake Mead. We're not there yet. There are some things that are really going to have to take a lot of really global, statewide thinking. And unfortunately, a lot of our leaders are looking very parochially, and that is not what's going to lead us out of this.
To follow up on what Allhands and I talked about, we invited two water experts in. Dave White is director of ASU's Decision Center for a Desert City, and Ray Quay is director of engagement there. Dave, let me start with you. The state of Arizona has been credited with having a vision when it comes to water banking and other storage, but where are we in terms of what the individual consumer may need to change about water usage?
Well, I would say the state, as you mentioned, has been progressive in its approach to conservation over the last three decades. And because of that, and because of our successes in conservation, there have been relatively few impacts to individual consumers, to homeowners, to businesses, to farmers even. As we move forward and we anticipate the kinds of challenges that we will face with the potential for a declaration of shortage on the Colorado River, as the impacts of climate change materialize, we will begin to see the need for additional water conservation and additional behavior changes among all sectors of society, including residents.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the differences between water conservation and restrictions that we may have to experience during that is that restrictions can be very draconian as long as people see them as being short term. If they become, people view them as being long term, then they begin to affect their concepts of quality of life and they could affect the economy. So we like to distinguish between what you have to do during a restriction and what you do with conservation. Conservation is something you fold into your quality of life and you fold into the economy over a long period of time.
So how much of this comes down to whether people feel as though they're able to make the choice themselves or whether it's being forced upon them?
Yeah, I think that's really important. I think it's important for policymakers and for those of us in the professional class to communicate to the public the rationale for conservation measures, whether they be measures that are long-term parts of our planning and strategy or they're short-term responses to drought or other crises.
Recent survey of the general public in the Phoenix area. First, just in terms of general attitude, coming back to that question, which I think is a key one, do people seem like they're prepared for changes? Do they know enough about potential shortages to say, yes, I may be willing to make those changes voluntarily?
Yes, and so at Decision Center for a Desert City, we recently conducted a random sample survey of residents of the Phoenix metropolitan region. And the results indicated that people saw the need for some significant changes to our water management strategies over the long term to ensure broad-based sustainability. And it was somewhat surprising to see that residents understood that there is a need for change, and they supported several strategies that we could implement to help bring about that transition.
And what were some of those key strategies that seem to make sense?
And so specifically, we found significant levels of support for people becoming more involved in participating in their water management decisions. We saw more than 70% of the respondents supported, for example, gathering and storing rainwater to irrigate landscaping. We saw a somewhat surprising level of support. More than 40% of the participants in our survey supported wastewater being treated to meet drinking quality standards and delivered directly to residents. And so this recycling and direct reuse of effluent is a surprising trend. The level of support was surprising to us.
You two are not PR professionals, but does the term wastewater need to change its name in order to get more acceptance?
Well, I think we need to focus on the right quality of water for the right purpose. Right? And so recycling water and reusing that water, we just need to focus on what's the quality of that water for the purpose. And so we can clean water to a specific quality to use for non-food agriculture. Mm-hmm. We can clean water to a different quality to use for cooling the nuclear power plant. And if we want to clean water to the highest quality for drinking water, we can do that. We have the technology to do that. The question is really just about the cost and the necessity.
There's been more efficiency in terms of the water usage around the valley. Are we at a point where efficiency and getting more efficient can help? Or once we get to a point of needing to make changes, it can no longer be done technologically. It's going to have to be done, individuals, communities having to take place.
Well, most of the water efficiency that we've increased over the last few years has been in indoor water use. And that's been the technology that you're talking about. I mean, everybody participates in that today. You can't buy an inefficient toilet or a shower head. And really the issue is just penetration of how we're going to get to the older appliances that are inefficient over time. And that is a technology issue. But the other realm is outdoor water use. And we have not seen as significant efficiency increases in outdoor as we have seen for indoor. And that's really going to be more of a value-based issue, less of a technology issue. So people are going to have to decide how much lawn do I really need and what do I use it for and what can I get rid of and what do I actually have? Do I need misters to cool on my porch time? Do I need a pool? These are all real value issues. They're not really technology. Mm-hmm. And so as we move forward and we're focused on increasing efficiency over the head, these issues of values about how we use outdoor water are going to become very important.
Is everyone going to have to make some sort of sacrifice or compromise? Based on this, the drought cycle, what has happened, and the Colorado River Compact, the drought contingency plan, all these things, are we going to see dramatic changes, and are they going to be gradual or, again, fairly dramatic immediately?
Well, I think the first answer is yes. Everyone needs to participate in this process across all sectors of society, across residential, industrial, and agricultural. We are adapting to a new normal. The drought has lasted now nearly two decades. It's the deepest drought in the observed historical record. All of the drying that we're seeing and the increases in temperature are entirely consistent with the projections that we have for the impacts of global climate change. And so I do believe that we will have to make more significant interventions in our system to go along with the incremental changes that we've been making over the last several decades.
You know, when we experience reductions on the Colorado River water, it will not occur equally for everybody over a short period of time. Different people will be affected at different points in time, and agriculture will be one of the first to be affected. And they will lose their surface water rights for some time period while we're experiencing these droughts. Some of them will switch to groundwater, which will increase the cost of water, which will increase the cost of the farm goods, which will change the business structure that they have. Some won't have any choices, and they'll have to move farming to other locations. So there will be fairly quick changes that will occur within agriculture when we experience those restrictions.
Is there a philosophical view of what the average person thinks about water in the valley and how that is going to change? It's almost like water is our constant companion now. We can sort of do with it what we want within reason, but how is that going to change how we see it, and how important is that to have a different sort of vision for it?
Well, I would say, first of all, that residents in this valley, by and large, are more aware of water issues than residents in other locations around the country, because water is a scarce and precious resource in this region, and people are simply more aware of the value of water to support all of the benefits to their communities, from the economy to the environment to their recreation spaces. So I think there's an underlying awareness of water. One of the findings in our survey research study also showed that the greater a person's environmental value orientation, the more likely they were to support improvements and strategies to transform our water system to be more sustainable. And so it's one of the things that we can focus on is raising awareness about environmental values and environmental orientations among the public, because we believe that would then lead to greater levels of public support for improvements.
So, Ray, does the philosophical attitude then blend in with the practical. So if you realize the importance of the issue, you're more bound to do practical things, and as we started with our conversation, in a way that makes sense for your lifestyle.
Yeah, now that water conservation is going to be discussing more about people's values and how do they value the water for the quality of life or the economy, understanding that they have this underlying concept about personal responsibility is going to make it easier for us to talk to them about those values. And they have to make the choices. And some people may say, well, I'm keeping my misters, but I'm getting rid of the pool. Some say, "May I need my turf, but I can get rid of the pool." Everybody will make value judgments on their own. And knowing that they have these underlying philosophical concepts will help us be able to deal with them in terms of making them, help them understand how those values affect themselves.
Dave White, Ray Quay of ASU's Decision Center for a Desert City. Guys, thanks.
Thank you, Steve.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Thanks for listening. From the Science Desk, here's a conversation from KJZZ's The Show and the latest data. KJZZ's Steve Goldstein has the details.
Vaccines have been highly effective at reducing deadly diseases in the U.S., but that doesn't mean infections like measles are a thing of the past. In fact, there's new concern about outbreaks in places where more children are not being vaccinated.
A new study published in the Public Library of Science journal, PLOS Medicine, found opposition to vaccines has been growing in recent years, and measles outbreaks have increased too. Phoenix has the largest number of unvaccinated kids in the nation, the researchers say, and that makes the area a big target for an outbreak. Joining us now to break this down is one of the authors of that report. Melissa Nolan is assistant professor of epidemiology at the University of South Carolina. Melissa, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So the report talks about hotspots for unvaccinated kids. How do you define what a hotspot is?
Well, we looked at it two different ways. So one, we wanted to look at the sheer percentage of non-vaccinated children. And with that, we saw that 8 out of 10 counties that had the highest percentage of kids that were unvaccinated came from Idaho. And then the other way we wanted to look at it was the sheer number of kids that were unvaccinated. And that was where we saw Arizona, Phoenix in particular, had the highest overall count of kids that were unvaccinated. So those are the two primary ways that we would define hotspots for unvaccinated children.
So as an epidemiologist who studies this kind of thing, what do you take that to mean? I mean, what does that mean in this case for the Phoenix metro area to have all these kids who have not been vaccinated?
Yeah, so I think the concern for us, especially me being an infectious disease epidemiologist, is that we've done such a great job of developing vaccines that are safe and effective. And the concern is that we rely on what we call herd immunity to protect kids that might have medical contraindications. So there's a certain percentage of the population that can't get vaccines for personal health reasons. And so we rely on others around them to be protected, to protect those children. It's a way of, being a humanitarian, in essence, in your community. So the concern then is that when people elect for philosophical reasons or personal-based or religious reasons to be vaccine exempt, then we're concerned that those other kids are highly vulnerable to it. And with measles, that's one of the ones we're most concerned about because it's a highly contagious bacterial infection that can be very severe. In fact, 1 out of every 4 cases of measles is hospitalized. It can lead to encephalitis in children, which can lead to hearing loss, and it can lead to other learning disabilities as a result.
Did your research break down, for example, in the Phoenix area, again, how many of the kids who were not vaccinated were because of medical reasons and how many were not? I mean, do we know that a lot of people here are choosing not to be vaccinated as opposed to having a medical reason why they can't?
So our study found that there were close to 3,000 children, kindergartners and specifically, in the Maricopa County area that were choosing not to be vaccinated.
And you talked about having sort of that herd immunity system. I mean, in an area like Phoenix, which is not necessarily as dense as a place like New York or Washington, D.C. or some of the East Coast cities, does that pose more of a risk in an urban area as opposed to, for example, in Yavapai County, Arizona, which in the past has had a fairly high number of unvaccinated kids as well, but a more urban environment? Is there a difference between the urban and rural risk?
I think that's a great question, and that's not something that we were necessarily able to look at with this study, but we have seen, there's an example in 2015, there was a large multi-state measles outbreak that was linked to an amusement park in California. In that situation, it was a visitor, actually from another country, that had measles that was had elected to be unvaccinated, and that sparked a large outbreak in that city. And then because I think the concern with an urban environment is that you have travelers coming in and leaving, so there's always that risk for that multi-state outbreak.
Is this a question of state policy? I mean, you mentioned that Idaho had some of the highest percentages, and then the Phoenix area, Maricopa County, had the highest raw number. Is this just a state policy issue that maybe the reasons why people can choose not to be vaccinated are more broad in some states than others?
Sure. So there's 18 states right now that allow for philosophical-based exemptions. So that means only within those states people can elect for personal reasons not to vaccinate their children. However, there's other opportunities for religious-based exemptions, and those are in 47 states that allow those. So I would say the biggest concern for us is looking at these philosophical-based exemptions, and what we found is that 12 of the 18 states that allow these personal belief exemptions are have an increase in these exemption rates and the number of kids that are being unvaccinated. So certainly in the areas where you see policy that permit children to be unvaccinated, that then transforms to children actually being unvaccinated.
All right. Melissa Nolan is an assistant professor of epidemiology at the University of South Carolina. Melissa, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
In business news, since the light rail extension opened along 19th Avenue in Phoenix 2 years ago, residents and businesses have complained about people panhandling and trespassing. But they're also taking action, working with the city to create a master development plan and hopping on a bus several weeks ago to show off assets and opportunities to potential investors. From KJZZ's business desk, Christina Estes reports.
Hello!
The bus tour, organized by Local First Arizona, begins with a success story at 19th Avenue and Camelback Road.
This store always is performing as one of our top stores. It's always one or two.
That's out of eight stores Zia Records operates, says Mary Poppenhausen.
And we transformed what was a dilapidated, abandoned kind of CVS situation that a corporate from not Arizona couldn't understand. So being a local business, Arizona business, we said, this is amazing property. We've always been around. Let's take it.
Listening intently is real estate investor Max Palacio.
I think that it's poised to grow.
The proof, he thinks, is in an older apartment complex he bought. After renovations, Palacio says the property at 16th Ave and Camelback is attracting people who were paying a lot more to live downtown.
It takes some time to understand a neighborhood and understand, yeah, as I said before, the dynamics of it. And I took the time to do that. The results have been really good.
Thank you so much for coming.
As the bus moves north, Pam Fitzgerald describes where she's lived for 48 years. Technically known as the Washington Park neighborhood, residents call 23rd Avenue in Maryland a hidden gem.
We've got a tennis center, a dog park, a swimming pool, a highly ranked high school, and we're right in the middle of the city. And I still feel when I'm in my backyard that I'm out in the country. It's quiet.
Welcome to our second stop.
Standing under a massive pine tree, Fitzgerald addresses a handful of potential developers.
We're hoping to get some new investment and some exciting new life into this neighborhood.
And particularly, what do you want? Particularly, what would you want?
Wine bar!
Boom!
That's Shannon McBride piping up. She's executive director of 19 North, a collaboration of residents, businesses, schools, and nonprofits stretching from 15th to 23rd Avenues, just south of Bethany Home, north to Dunlap.
There's a whole bunch of us like that. They just are invested in this community.
And more people are moving to one of the city's most socioeconomically diverse areas. Investors are flipping 50-year-old houses, while developers are building low-income apartments and selling new houses for $300,000 to $600,000.
I'm proud to live here.
Carrie Buffoe also sells real estate in the area. Lately, she's been keeping tabs on the northeast corner of 19th Ave and Bethany Home, across from Christown Mall.
Those of you that have been around for a while know the car wash and where the old Weinberger used to be, and that is under development.
Documents filed with the city show at least one restaurant with outdoor seating is being planned. Phoenix's economic development director tells me 19 North will attract significant restaurants and retail. It'll just take time. When the tour began, Councilman Daniel Valenzuela put it this way.
It's a transitioning area, right? We're not going to walk you through Disneyland today.
That becomes evident at Dunlap, at the public plaza where the light rail line ends, and some people don't like sharing the space.
Get the f*** out of my way.
Security's been increased along the line, and Pam Fitzgerald says it's helped her neighborhood.
I love my house, and I'm not going anywhere. The people that shouldn't be here are the ones that need to go.
The tour ends at Northern, where Shannon McBride takes investor Max Palacio inside the former Good Shepherd Home for Girls.
These were the nuns' dorm rooms.
Built in 1942, it served as a girls' home until 1981 and is listed on Phoenix's Historic Property Register. McBride shows Palacio the blueprints.
Oh, wow.
I know, it's insane. And that's an arch, and this is an arch.
Palacio plans to take a closer look. And even though no one's designing a wine bar yet, Pam Fitzgerald is already celebrating.
It excites me to see this area come back and be what it was when I first moved here.
Christina Estes, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
And you're listening to the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. In education news, this year, Arizona issued public schools letter grades for the first time since 2014. From the KJZZ Education Desk, Mariana Dale reports the way the state evaluates schools has been evolving for the last two decades. Some of the state's lowest performing schools say it's still a system that hurts more than it helps.
Mesquite Elementary in Casa Grande is one of 161 schools that received a D grade this year. Julie Holdsworth is the principal.
It's frustrating. It made me sad. But I don't think it paints the whole picture of our school.
Holdsworth is proud of her school and its 450 students. Most kids here qualify for a free or reduced price lunch. At the start of every school day, Holdsworth holds a staff meeting in the library.
We go around the circle and we greet each other. And then we open it up for sharing, and it's often staff might share on a test score went up or a student had a great day of behavior. And we applaud for each other.
Explaining the D grade is a more complicated conversation. Holdsworth pulls up her school's evaluation on the computer.
It's exhaustive. There's a lot to look at.
The school's grade is based on a complicated formula. It includes student scores on standardized tests in language arts and math. There's growth on those tests from year to year, and other factors like how well English language learners perform.
I know we were 4.99 points away from a C. But we don't get a D plus.
Casa Grande Superintendent Joetta Gonzalez says not only does it feel bad, but she worries the district will lose out on an important source of public money.
When we're not adequately funded by state and we're reliant on overrides and bond elections in order to just get by, it could be damaging to the vote that comes out.
What's frustrating, Gonzalez says, is charter schools don't have to abide by the same rules. If a charter school doesn't meet expectations, the school only has to tell current students' families. Arizona Education Department spokesman Stefan Swyatt says the department would support changes to the state's law.
They would recommend that the law read to say that all notices just go out to the parents of children that attend the schools, respective of charter or district. And that way it would be a level playing field.
Arizona's accountability system for district and charter schools goes back to 2000. That's when Arizona lawmakers passed a bill with framework for how the state should evaluate schools and what should happen to schools that aren't performing. John Hoopenthal was chairman of the Senate Education Committee at the time.
As I look back on that now, I regret having been part of that.
Arizona's standards were some of the first in what would be a nationwide wave of education accountability policies. Arizona switched from labels like excelling and underperforming to more recognizable letter grades of A through F in 2010. Hoopenthal went on to be the state superintendent of public instruction. He's been dismayed that schools in impoverished areas make up the majority of failing schools.
Here we have this letter grading system that comes in and is beating the hell out of schools that are serving the most at-risk populations.
It's not about being punitive to the school, it's about being fair to families.
Lisa Keegan was another architect of Arizona's accountability policy. Like Hoopenthal, she served in the legislature and later as state superintendent of public instruction. But they differ in their views on how the state evaluates schools.
It isn't just, can we make sure that schools that are not performing get better? It is, can we make sure that schools that are already great get bigger? and that kids have more access to them.
Keegan believes parents' ability to send their kids to a different school is key. Still, schools with bad grades are trying to get better because principals like Julie Holdsworth aren't happy with a poor evaluation.
Am I going to let this letter define us, or are we just going to aim for good instruction, doing what's right for kids? Yes, that's what we're going to do.
The state requires D and F schools to create an improvement plan. Holdsworth has already started working on it. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Casa Grande.
And finally, from the Fronteras desk, here's KJZZ's Steve Goldstein.
Arizona-Mexico Commission is meeting over the next couple of days in southern Arizona. And joining us now is Michel Morisco, senior editor of KJZZ's Fronteras desk. Michel, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
So this is an event that happens twice a year in Sonora and here in Arizona. We've already heard about new customs projects here at the Mesa Gateway Airport, where SkyBridge, first airport in America to house customs officers from both countries, creating an international hub. You've covered the ADOT project that will improve the Mexican highway leading to Rocky Point. There could be some great highlights at this summit this year. What are you expecting?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I expect more of the same focus on this quote-unquote mega region that Arizona and Sonora have been pushing for the past year or so. And this is this climate of working together to try to draw industry. That's going to be the big push at this summit. And they're not only pushing for cross-border industry, but also, it's interesting, they're going for cross-border technology. In Puerto Peñasco last year, like you said, the focus was on the improvement to the Mexican highway leading to the port. There was also a major focus on education and partnerships between Arizona and Sonora campuses. This year, it's going to be business.
Now, you've reported on this before. We've also heard the politicians here in Arizona talk about those traditional business interests that both states have always shared. There's agriculture, like farming and ranching and mining. But so you're saying there could be a push in a different direction now?
Yeah, I interviewed Bruce Wright, and he's the Associate Vice President for Tech Parks Arizona at the University of Arizona. And this is what he had to say on what he calls the innovation economy.
Well, I mean, the innovation economy is all about discovering and developing new technology and then integrating that technology or infusing it into the economy in the form of products and services that can then generate economic development. Both Arizona and Sonora have made a strong commitment to expanding the technology sector within both states, and we see the opportunity for collaboration between the two states and mutually beneficial kinds of outcomes.
Okay, and what kind of economies are the two states really aiming at here?
And he's speaking about aerospace and automotive industries. Wright and others, they're looking to expand the autonomous vehicle industry, both on the streets, but also in the mines. And they want to use existing and create new infrastructure on both sides of the border. And they're also looking to the drone market. I also spoke with Mary Darling. She's the CEO of Darling Geomatics, and they're a high-tech survey company that creates 3D maps of areas.
I'm going to talk about innovations that apply to the automotive, aerospace, power, mining, and agriculture industries.
Now, Darling is interesting. She has extensive experience working in Mexico, but even she's going to be here today to learn what new projects that she can apply her specific technology to.
And in addition to the states, we've got some growing cities that are strongly represented in this year's commission as well. What sort of ideas are you hearing that cities might have to woo some of these new industries?
Yeah, so one that really caught my attention was Douglas, Arizona. They have some marked improvements that they're really eager to show off. They spent about $20 million to finally upgrade their wastewater treatment plan, and they're even adding faster internet. They're bringing in an agreement with Cox Cable for 100 megabytes per second of internet speeds. Those are two major selling points that Douglas Mayor Robert Uribe is going to introduce today, and I spoke with him yesterday on this.
Two components to, you know, expanding the wastewater treatment at $20 million, the internet improvement. I mean, now we are in a competitive market. Now we can, and plus we have other incentives for businesses that are looking to expand and grow their business. And that puts us in conversation because in the past, our infrastructure was not that sound.
So, Michel, as you talked about, there's been a great economic relationship, again, rebuilding recently between Arizona and Mexico, really vital to this region. Did you get a sense from the folks you talked to that there is optimism that at this micro level, the two sides can battle through, continue the great relationship? Even at the national level, there's a little bit of concern.
Well, and that was a major concern and a focus last year, was how are these areas, these mega regions, Arizona and Sonora, how are they going to thrive and work together in this time of absolute contentiousness? You know, on the other hand, when you look at the World Cup agreement that was just announced yesterday, in spite of the politicking, the Twitter attacks, the commentaries, both countries do appear to ultimately get along and hit that bottom line. And then this summit, this time, it's going to be business.
From KJZZ's Fronteras Desk, that's Michel Morisco. He's reporting from the Arizona-Mexico Commission 2018 Summit in Tucson. Michel, always good to talk with you. Thanks.
Hey, thank you. Thank you.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, the IEEE Foundation, the Cancer Treatment Centers of America, ASU Research, Beach Fleischmann, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening to KJZZ and for your generous support. I'm Tiara Vian, and this is KJZZ, your news and information station.